Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 111 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Now, there's an easy number to remember. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. Today I thought we'd talk about climate change. It's commonly said that 97% or 99% of climate scientists agree with climate change. That's actually a fake number by arbitrarily excluding a large number of scientists who don't. But generally in the mainstream media, all you hear is that climate change is a fact, and that anybody who disagrees with climate change is just doing it because they're taking money from Exxon or Shell or BP or something like that. But there are actually well-qualified climate scientists who have some concerns about climate change. They don't deny everything, but they question a lot. Today, let's talk to one of those. Judith Curry is a professor and former chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she currently teaches thermodynamics of atmospheres and oceans. She won a PhD in 1982 from the University of Chicago in the subject of geophysical sciences. Previously, she was a professor at University of Colorado at Boulder, associate professor at Penn State Department of Meteorology, assistant prof at Purdue's Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, and started at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Meteorology. She's written numerous papers on the atmosphere and global temperatures and other subjects, including the Arctic. So, Judith, I think your resume says that you're qualified to speak on climate change, so welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
So what was your position when climate change first became a big issue, and has it evolved over time?
Well, I frankly didn't pay much attention to it.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, it's an issue that was there. I never paid much attention to it until 2005, if you want to know the truth.
Okay.
And 2005 is when I inadvertently got caught up in the public debate on climate change over a paper we had published on hurricanes and global warming. And that sort of introduced me to the whole crazy debate and forced me to look at some of the broader issues, the issues outside my own personal research topics.
Okay, what did that paper say, basically?
Well, the particular paper was, and this was published through some crazy fluke, 2 weeks after Hurricane Katrina struck Louisiana.
Right.
And the main finding of our paper was that the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes had doubled globally since 1970. So basically what we're saying is that there's a greater percentage of the hurricanes are actually going to Category 4 and 5.
So that seemed like it was in line with the whole global warming thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So,
yeah, we
so
didn't say
you must have been an error.
War, you know. Right, right. And so obviously that chimed in with... you know, the global warming agenda, and we were adopted by, you know, the global warming activists, you know, and mm-hmm. we had to take a good hard look at the whole broader issue of global warming, and we decided that it was a responsible thing to support the consensus. That's what we decided at that time.
So you started saying, well, we got data, and it seems to be concordant with the theory that the climate is warming, and therefore...
Exactly. We didn't have a big global warming message ourselves. It would just say that it's associated with the increases in tropical sea surface temperature. Okay, and why is the tropical sea surface temperature warming? Well, the IPCC consensus states that it's because of human-caused global warming.
Right.
And what they basically say, I believe, is that there's been a 0.8 degree C surface temperature change since 1900, and most of that's occurred since the 1970s. That, I guess, is the hockey stick.
The temperature has increased over the last century. About 40% of that increase occurred in the early part of the century, with 60% of it occurring, you know, in the latter half of the 20th century and early 21st century. So, yeah, that's most, but there was substantial warming in the early part of the 20th century, too, that nobody has a particularly good explanation for.
Well, I guess I was going to ask you, I mean, one of the problems with measuring the weather is the further back you go, the less information you have. I mean, if you go back before the industrial age, you probably didn't have thermometers for people to actually measure the temperature, so you got to look at things like ice cores or something like that to try to guess what the temperature might be.
Right. As you go back in time, the historical data becomes increasingly sparse, but certainly over the land areas, it's pretty good, you know, back to the beginning of the 20th century.
Right.
Yeah, but then you have to use, you know, to go back further, you have some sparse historical records that go back a number of centuries in a few instances. So you have a handful of very long historical records. But it's just a handful, you know, and so then you have to look at the paleoclimate proxies, the tree rings, and so on.
Right.
And there's always ambiguities in interpreting those, and the temporal resolution on many of those proxies isn't very good. You can't really look at, for many of them, you can't really look at sub-century variations.
Well, so I mean, if tree rings were perfect, you should be able to look at, you know, tree rings in Italy and tree rings in South America and sort of see the same kinds of patterns if there were global variations, or even in two different places in Italy. I mean, how does that work out? Do you?
Well, the problem with tree rings is tree rings don't only respond to temperature, but they respond to rainfall and changes in atmospheric composition. So how to deconvolve all that and get some sort of an unambiguous temperature signal is not straightforward at all.
Right. Plus, I mean, the microenvironment of a tree, like if a tree starts growing sort of in the underbrush and then there's a big storm and all of a sudden it's in the sun for a while and then the forest fills in. I mean, there's a lot of those factors that you will 100,000 years later have no information about what was happening in the forest.
A lot of ambiguities. And compounding factors in interpreting those records.
Right. And even more recently, like I think we've been able to measure temperatures pretty accurately for, I don't know, I'm guessing like a century, maybe more, like within less than a degree. But it's more than just the thermometer. Like one criticism that's being made is that meteorological stations are often placed at airports, which have gone from sort of an open field, maybe in the 1920s, to now, you know, basically an industrial zone with no foliage at all and lots of reflective building surfaces.
Exactly. Land use change, you know, is a big compounding factor, you know, and an ancillary issue is the actual sighting of the weather observations. So people who process those data sets have some statistical methods for trying to account for all that, but and then we get into the land of adjustment. So some of the data records become very substantially adjusted,
which is a problem.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, there's a problem with humans because if you have particular axe to grind. You either believe or don't believe in climate change, and you're in charge of adjusting the numbers. Even if you think you're doing it in an unbiased way, you might kind of keep doing it until it sort of concords with your perception of what reality should be.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways that we can fool ourselves. Again, it's the job of scientists to try to minimize all that. But when a topic gets politicized in the way that climate change has, it becomes increasingly difficult for scientists to be objective about what they're doing.
Right. I don't know if this has any relevance, but I did a little back of the envelope calculation. I said to myself, okay, well, the temperature goes up and down every day, probably in most places, 10 degrees Celsius. That's probably more than that. I know here where I live, it's often 20, even 30 degrees in one day. And it does that every day of the year. So if I multiply that out by 116 years, which is 1900 is when they are using as a reference point, that's like 500,000 degrees of change over time. And out of that, we're trying to find 0.8 degrees as a change, which is a pretty small signal in huge amount of noise.
Yeah, it's a very small signal given all the uncertainties that we're faced with. I think the idea that the climate has been warming, you know, for the last 100 years, I think that's generally believable, but how much is a question. I think that there's significant uncertainty about that. And then the bigger issue is what's actually causing the warming. There's a lot of disagreement on the question, and that's really the key issue.
It seems to me that policy is based totally on CO2, and yet, you know, in discussions, occasionally they bring up methane, water vapor, and other global warming gases, and yet, like, nobody's saying that we need to put dehumidifiers up around the country to remove water vapor because of its global warming potential. And I don't know if anybody's doing anything about methane, although there may be some like methane minimization systems.
Oh, there is. President Obama has a pretty ambitious anti-methane plan.
Mm-hmm.
And chlorofluorocarbons, and yeah. So they are looking at the other trace gases. But what concerns me more is the failure to really account for and investigate solar variability and the long-term ocean oscillations, which have very substantial impacts on climate variability on multi-decadal to century to millennial timescales. And we're not paying enough attention to these.
Well, one thing that I'd read recently, and I guess I'm interviewing you because I don't know the answers to these questions, but somebody wrote that they've changed the way that they measure the ocean temperature, that it's like based on a thermometer down by the propeller shaft or something. Like, I wasn't quite sure how they were doing it, but that's changed over time where they put the thermometer. And again, it implied they had to adjust as best they could for that change.
The ocean temperatures are, again, there's huge challenges with that. Apart from the sparse sampling, you have the issue of measurement techniques and locations. Ship intake, bucket temperatures versus buoys at the surface versus satellite observations, you end up getting different answers. And so how do you try to adjust those measurements to try to get a homogeneous data set? And so
which wouldn't be such a big problem if it wasn't such a small signal that people are trying to find.
Exactly.
And so do you think we know that the oceans are warming, or is that still
open? Yeah, I think the sign, you know, we understand the sign of the temperature change, and it is overall in a warming direction. The magnitude, that there's significant uncertainties. And when you start talking about warmest years and stuff like that, you know, the uncertainties are sufficiently large that, you know, the signals are you know, rather ambiguous.
And that's supposed to reflect in the, I mean, in the rise in sea levels, which would presumably be affected by the temperature causing water to expand slightly.
Right.
And also more ice to melt and come into the oceans and things like that. But also all land is either going up or down. Every island is either rising or sinking, mostly sinking, I think. So it's kind of like the theory of relativity, right? Like you can put, if you have an island and you've got the sea level, how do you know the difference between the sea level rising and the island sinking?
Yeah, the issue of sea level rise, I mean, the sea level rise has overall been, you know, sea level's been rising for the overall for the last 10,000 years. We're coming out of an ice age. But there's been, you know, peaks and valleys for the sea level rise. You know, the little ice age, you know, 2, 3, 4 centuries ago, the sea level was sinking slightly associated with the cooling. And then in the 1800s, we saw, you know, a rise, you know, starting again. And we've seen some ups and downs in terms of faster rates of rise or slower rates of rise, you know, varying with temperatures and the multi-decadal ocean oscillation.
Right. I remember my great-grandmother lived in a small backwater town in the south of England, which had once been a very important port, I think back in the 1400s or something, several hundred years ago, but it had gradually dried up, probably because the land was rising in that part of England, whereas other places it was falling.
Yeah, there's several compounding factors apart from just the expansion and adding more water.
Right.
One is just rising and sinking of the land. And then the other ones have to do with land use, whether you're engineering the rivers or the coast or the, you know, the marshes or whatever. And also groundwater depletion causes the land to sink. So there's a couple of land use factors that are pretty dominant in many locations.
Well, some people said that the 2005 Katrina hurricane was exacerbated by the fact that the sort of the wetlands in the Mississippi Delta had been significantly destroyed and disturbed.
Yeah, our coastal engineering and the engineering of the Mississippi, basically, you know, we have, you know, played a major role in the problems that New Orleans faced as a result of Katrina.
Right, like the canalization of rivers, you know, building berms and more land on the side of the rivers that's paved as opposed to forest, which increases the rapidity with which the water goes into the river after a storm.
Yes.
Well, plus the fact that the dam around, what's the lake by New Orleans that's got
Slidell.
Yeah, and it's got basically
that
a giant wall.
I can't remember the name of the lake.
Pontchartrain.
Pontchartrain, yes.
Yes.
Slidell is the town right there.
Right. And so the Army Corps of Engineers, I think, had built a great big wall around the lake, which was actually higher than New Orleans. So when the water came over the lake, then New Orleans flooded, making the whole thing a lot worse. So it wasn't just the force of the hurricane. I think it's pretty clear.
Right.
Yes, but I don't know if anybody wants to deal with how do we improve. I shouldn't say that. There are people who recognize that the coastal forests are really important, that they've been damaged a lot, and we'd be better off if there were more of them.
Yeah, no, I think there's a growing realization that nature has some very good defenses that we don't want to interfere, or that we even want to help restore.
Yeah, I think in Asia the mangrove forests have a huge impact too, and the tsunamis, which are caused by the movements of the earth and not by the weather, are a lot worse when there's no mangrove forests, because the water can go straight onto the land and into the towns. There's no barrier. You were also, apart from sea levels, you were talking about one other thing earlier.
I've talked about a lot of things. I'm not sure what you're referring
to. The sun. The sun. So what do you think the effect of the sun is? How are there cycles with the sun? Has this basically been ignored?
Well, I think that there's a lot that we don't know about the sun. There's evidence that there are, you know, long-term cycles, even out to, you know, 10,000 years. And this is on shorter time scales than the Ice Age kind of time scales. But, you know, sort of multi-decadal to multi-millennial time scale, there's a whole host of oscillations, you know, in the sun, solar activity, and it seems like there's some lag effects, you know, of these oscillations on the climate, with the ocean circulation sort of being the mediator or the flywheel. And, you know, we haven't come close to sorting all that out. But the people who do this kind of research, trying to understand what's going on with the sun, most of them are predicting some sort of a solar minimum mid-21st century. And a few are predicting a grand solar minimum, like a really big one, sometime in the mid-23rd century. So, you know, with the potential to cause significant cooling. And the mechanisms by which the sun influences the Earth's climate, apart from the obvious heat, there are other more complex mechanisms, indirect solar effects, that haven't been teased out, and not very many of those are included in the climate models. So we don't really know enough about this, but there's potential for it to be very substantially important, and we just don't know.
Well, I've wondered if the amount of particulates that the Chinese and other countries that are still dependent on coal power are putting in the atmosphere is actually going to cause cooling of the atmosphere, because it's going to reflect light. So maybe we should give them a medal for what they're doing.
Okay. Well, if you put particulates in the atmosphere, they generally cool the surface, although if they're carbonaceous soot, they will actually have a slight warming effect on the surface. But overall, you know, particulates have a cooling effect on the Earth. But the air overall is getting cleaner in recent decades, notwithstanding, you know, really bad problems locally in China and India and South and Central Asia.
Right.
You know, generally. But overall, globally, it's been getting better. And recent research has shown that the climate is less sensitive to these particles than was previously thought. So I don't think we're seeing a huge cooling effect from those particles.
Yeah, I guess it was slightly tongue-in-cheek, because obviously burning coal is bad, even if whatever your thoughts are on global warming, the particulates in the atmosphere are causing epidemics of respiratory disease in China. So
right.
It's definitely not a good thing. And I'm certainly not a big fan of coal for a number of reasons, is particulates, and it puts heavy metals in the atmosphere and all kinds of things. But it seemed ironic that it might actually be cooling the climate, but maybe what you're saying, if it's carbonaceous, it's actually slightly contributing to warming.
A little bit, yeah. But yeah. It's not that, you know, a cooling, but it's not a real large factor.
Yeah. How much,
as far as health.
How much does solar output vary over, you know, between the minimum and the maximum? Do you know that?
In terms of watts per square meter, it's a few watts per square meter. It's not huge, but it's not, you know, it's non-trivial, but it's really some of the indirect effects that act to amplify that are potentially more interesting.
And what do you mean by indirect effects?
Oh, how it changes stratospheric chemistry, or how it influences clouds, cosmic ray effects, or, you know, some things like that, where it's not just the direct heating, you know, effect.
Right. I mean, what reaches us from the sun, the most important thing for us is light, which is also infrared light heat, right? But also there's cosmic rays.
Right. Well, there's visible radiation comes from the sun. That's mm-hmm. what heats us up mostly.
Right. But there's also cosmic rays. I mean, are
yes.
we affected, in your opinion, by the magnetic field of the sun?
The issue of how the magnetic field and changes to that interact with climate is something that we don't have much of an understanding about. Whether it's important or not, I don't know. It's one of those sort of unknown unknowns.
But, yeah, which is like when you're trying to figure out why the climate's changing and there's variables that you're not even really looking at or quantifying, that doesn't give me a lot of confidence that your model is going to be very accurate.
And, right.
And what would you say, I mean, climate models have been around, they're sort of multiplying rapidly, but they've been around long enough that we can sort of see how they've panned out and what has been the track record of climate models.
Well, climate models are generally running too hot relative to the observations, but it's rather difficult to compare them because of the multi-decadal ocean oscillations, which climate admittedly don't get right. And so when you have one of those going on, it sort of compounds the comparison. So the climate models don't have any skill on time scales, you know, less than maybe half a century. So if you're looking to compare the observations and the models on shorter time scales, it's very difficult to make sense of it since we already know the climate models don't get the ocean oscillations right.
Oscillations of temperature in the oceans, or what kind
of everything, circulations, temperatures, whatever. They are a big driver of the climate. Have you heard of the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation? Well, think maybe the most common ocean oscillation is the El Niño, La Niña, okay, which goes on. But there's other modes of ocean oscillations on longer timescales. And so they have a powerful control on the climate.
Right, right. I mean, I don't know much about El Niño and La Niña, except that people will say, well, it's active this year, so it's going to be a warm winter. But nobody really knows if it's going to be back next year or not.
Well, we're not getting an El Niño back next year. The current debate is whether it's going to be La Niña or neutral.
Okay. And how does La Niña versus El Niño affect North American temperatures?
Well, La Niña is an overall cooling. It has regional manifestations, but overall it cools the globe, whereas overall El Niño warms the globe in terms of the surface temperatures.
Right. And I've also heard a lot of people talking about the pause, which I think is admitted even by people who are big proponents of global warming, that since about 2000, temperatures have either not been going up or not as fast as they were in the 90s.
Right. They were pretty flat, really, following 1998, and then we've seen a big uptick again in 2015, and 2016 will be another warm year. And so then I would expect, you know, La Niñas to ensue, you know, within a year or two, and, you know, so there's a lot of year-to-year variability, so you can't just look at one short period or a few years and really make any inferences about what's going on.
Right, which is a problem, but that's what people are doing, right? Like, we're told that we have to react, and we have to do maybe sometimes drastic things like pump CO2 into the ground, which is consuming a lot of energy, or pump particulates into the atmosphere. I mean, those seem pretty drastic things to me that could have unintended consequences.
Well, okay, the other key issue is, you know, independently of how much it's warming or what's causing the warming, is warming dangerous?
Mm.
Okay, we've been sold a bill of goods that warming is dangerous. Well, there are some good effects of warming. Plants like it. Good for agriculture. It's good generally for the, you know, planetary health and hygiene through the vegetation. More people die from cold temperatures than they do from warm temperatures. But there is the issue of sea level rise, and, you know, in some regions there seem to be more extreme events. But whether you could blame them on humans, we don't know. But, you know, to me, this is the big, the biggest question: is warming dangerous? I don't think they've ever made a particularly strong case that warming is very dangerous.
Since 2005, with Katrina, has there been a continuing increase in the hurricanes and the strength of the hurricanes that you saw up to that date?
Okay, well, there's a lot of year-to-year variability. And if you look at global, okay, if you look at Atlantic hurricanes, the last couple of years have been extremely quiet, and we've had a lack of landfalls. But if you look globally, there was sort of a hurricane drought following 2005, but last year was a record year in the Pacific, so that brought the global statistics sort of back towards the high end. Not a record, but back towards the high end. So there's a lot of year-to-year and decadal scale variability in global hurricane activity.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that in one year you have, you know, a busy year in the Pacific but not in the Atlantic indicates that it's not a consistent effect that's creating them.
Well, it's the El Niño, La Niña effect. El Niño means an active Pacific hurricane season, but an inactive Atlantic season.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a La Niña, it's the reverse, with an active Atlantic hurricane season and an inactive Pacific season. So there's sort of a seesaw.
Right.
And you have a lot more hurricanes in the Pacific than you do in the Atlantic. So, you know, what's going on in the Pacific really dominates the global statistics on hurricanes.
And I mean, I think when you have a really extreme weather event like the storm that resulted in a massive surge in New York, I forget what did they call that?
Oh, Hurricane Sandy.
Hurricane Sandy, yes, which was kind of a hurricane that was blowing itself out that coincided with a high tide that caused a massive storm surge that, you know, might have been just a coincidence. But when that happens, because it was so destructive, it really changes the political climate. Whereas if that storm had more energy but blown itself out in the middle of the Atlantic, we might never have really heard about it.
Yeah, exactly. It was an unusual path that it took, you know, and hit New York in a very vulnerable place. But overall, it wasn't a particularly strong hurricane. I think technically it wasn't even a hurricane at landfall. It had transitioned to a subtropical storm at that point. But it was a pretty big storm with a large horizontal extent, which generally contributes to a bigger storm surge.
Right, because it wasn't the wind that did the majority of the damage in that case,
understanding. Yeah, it was a storm surge, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's usually the case. The biggest damages come from the storm surges, usually.
And I mean, I think coincidence plays a big role. Like, this year in my province of Alberta, you probably heard about the fire in Fort McMurray. We had a dry spring and pretty much burned half this really important town, which ironically is important for the extraction of the tar sands up north. So there was a little bit of schadenfreude, occurring. People saying, oh, isn't that too bad that you're destroying the planet and the planet destroyed your city? There was a little bit of that. But we're right now having a really wet summer. Like, I think until today, it's rained every day for the last 10 days or something, which is pretty unusual in July, but not certainly unheard of. And if that rain had come in May, there would never have been a fire in Fort McKay. So, when you get the moisture in the year, it can have a huge impact on, getting enough dry days to produce a huge fire. And then it rains and everybody forgets about it. But whether that will happen next year or it'll be 20 years before the next big fire is hard to say.
Yeah.
Very difficult. One thing I've observed in the whole global warming debate is that the people who believe in destructive global warming are always complaining about their critics getting money from Exxon or from, some other nefarious source. But it seems to me that the media is generally pro-global warming, and most of these professors and researchers are getting pretty nice salaries from the government or from foundations to study global warming. And they don't really mind censoring people on the other side.
Oh, yeah, it's very asymmetrical. I mean, there's tons of government funding that's pro-global warming. The whole academic culture is pro-global warming. And in order to move science forward, you need a diversity of perspectives. And so the people with alternative perspectives have been marginalized, to use a polite word. Shouted down as deniers, ostracized, whatever. And so I actually think that the tiny amount of funding that some scientists do get from oil companies or whatever, I think they help promote alternative perspectives that are needed for the health of the scientific process. So I have a different take on oil company funding. I think it's needed to support a diversity of perspectives, since the government funding and the universities have become so biased on this subject. I think it's to the detriment of the scientific process.
And have you experienced any kind of censorship in terms of difficulty publishing, getting grants, or pressure on your university position?
Okay, I have no problem publishing papers. That's not been a problem. With regards to funding, I can't get government funding for the kind of stuff I want to do, so I've stopped trying. I've been ostracized by segments of the community, and there's people in the higher administration at my university that really don't like me and want me gone because of my perspective on global warming. But I have a tenured position. I'll hang on to it for a tiny bit longer.
Yeah. University tenure is actually a very important thing, because as the tides of opinion come and go, it can easily wash away an entire segment of opinion. And one of
Yeah, 10 years ago, yeah, exactly. I would have never believed, you know, that I would need tenure to protect, you know, what, you know, a meteorologist, atmospheric science, you know, what do we need tenure for? But it, over the last decade, it's become increasingly clear why tenure is needed and why it's very important. But it's a relatively, you know, minority, you know, of scientists that have tenure. There's a lot of them employed by the government where they don't feel like they can speak out, and there's a number of untenured research scientists at universities who don't feel that they can speak out. So it's not a healthy environment in the universities and government research labs for climate research.
I mean, I think science still puts forward this belief that, you know, scientists argue over things way beyond the point at which, you know, people should have agreed, and you just can't stop them from arguing. But I don't really think that's true at all with a lot of issues. Once there's enough of a majority to affect grants, publications, and even tenure is affected by peer review, right?
It's exactly.
So yeah. So once you have enough of, if it maybe 60% are on your side, you could pretty much exclude the other 40% from any power.
Yeah, there's a lot of unfortunate politics that goes on within science.
I mean, yeah, I was hearing in Canada that with medical grants, only 15% get approved.
Yeah.
Which I think sets up a zero-sum game, right? Like, you know that if you get your grant approved, somebody else didn't, and vice versa. And so the people at the hospital or the university in the town next to you are your enemy when it comes to grants. So if you can position yourself with a more politically favorable position, you can get maybe 20% of your grants approved, and they're only getting 10%. That's a good thing for you.
Yeah.
And I suppose even within do you see that within a university where people are positioning themselves at the expense of others?
Sure. All of the rewards. You know, if you have careerist goals, you want to rise up the academic food chain. You know, you want to pitch your science in a certain way, and you only want to work on certain problems. And it's, you know, even helped if you make certain public statements supporting the consensus and things like that. So scientists have pretty quickly figured out how to succeed in this environment, but some scientists have decided, no, I don't want to play that game. Okay, and they hurt their career trajectory. But
I think a lot of scientists get into science just like a lot of doctors get into medicine, because they have kind of an idealized view about what they're going to be doing.
Right.
And then it turns out that it's actually considerably different when they're actually in that position.
Right, right. It's very politicized and very, very sort of constrained. There's not a lot of academic freedom out there in the universities and the government labs.
Which is a pretty shocking statement, that there is not much academic freedom in the most academic institutions in the country.
Right, it's an issue of substantial concern, and it's in many fields and universities in general where we're seeing the politically correct police enforcing, you know, all sorts of things on campuses, and it's not a good situation.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue. People are becoming, I think, a lot of students are hypersensitive about anything that could possibly offend them, and yet they're supposed to be going into an institution that's going to challenge them. I don't know how you can combine those two things. And if I was to lean one way or the other, I'd say if if things in university make you uncomfortable, that's a good thing. You got to figure out how to deal with it. And if you can't argue back when somebody makes you feel uncomfortable, maybe you need to, you know, sit down and think about next time you have that argument, how are you going to win it? That's how you get better at it. And it also seems like from a university administration point of view, the best scientists are the ones who bring in the most money. Is that a correct statement?
It depends on the university. Some define impact more broadly. Funding is necessary but not sufficient.
Right.
You know, at the most prestigious institutions.
But, yeah, what they say, I mean, have you seen a difference between what institutions say and what they actually do? Because, you know, budget is pretty important to the administration.
No, the absolute elite universities, you know, have huge endowments and whatever, and they're not that worried about what an individual faculty member brings in. I mean, cumulatively, they want to see good research funding. But it's right. The second tier of universities, you know, a lot of big state universities who really need that grant funding. And it's
right.
More of a driver, I think, for some of the second-tier state universities.
Right. I mean, this is sort of going off on a tangent, but I think one of the problems in university sports has been the amount of money it brings in. And so even when something happens like the pedophilia scandal at, was it the University of Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania? I always get those mixed up. Penn State. When that happened, you know, it seemed like it was the money that caused them to not want to deal with it. Whereas if there had been no money involved, I think they probably would have dealt with it a lot sooner.
I think there are bigger issues than money.
Status?
It was a complex. I was at Penn State circa 1990, mm-hmm. and it was a culture. It was very a top-down, good old boy kind of culture, and I just think they thought they could get away with whatever they wanted to. And, that they could cover it up if they wanted to. They weren't answerable to anybody. It was just sort of an arrogance.
Right. So if you were on the inside, they were going to protect you, and if you were on the outside, they didn't care.
Yeah, right. And Joe Paterno was sort of a god there. So the whole football team had this, you know, untouchable status to it.
Right. I mean, I guess it's not just the money, but the alumnus are really happy, which is probably not really a factor in science. Like, I don't really think, do the alumni care about, what
university? Oh, okay. Yeah, they do. Okay. When I was investigated by Representative Grijalva, I was one of the 7 scientists that he went after because we testified for the Republicans in congressional hearings.
Right.
And requested all sorts of information about me, whatever. Apparently the Georgia Tech alumni really rose up and defended me and wrote many letters to the president of the university and so on.
And Grijalva is supposedly a progressive, right?
Yeah, he's a progressive, yes. Or thinks of himself in that way.
I mean, that seems pretty extraordinary.
I would characterize that as Gestapo tactics, not progressive. But I believe he considers himself to be progressive.
Yeah, I think I consider myself to be progressive on some issues, but I think that the term sometimes is associated with some pretty horrible behavior. So I'm using it in ironic quotes a lot more. Because I think on things like immigration issues and things like that, he would be very considerate about people's feelings, like, undocumented immigrants and that kind of stuff. But I guess, I guess politics is a team sport, right? You choose. You're either playing for the Democrats, you're playing for the Republicans, and if you want to win the game, you know anything goes. In terms of tactics, I mean, I think I saw a paper or an article a few years ago saying that global warming denialists should be executed by some liberal progressive person, which was even extreme for most progressives.
Yeah.
But that is extraordinary that a congressional witness would be investigated afterwards, presumably to try to undercut your testimony.
Exactly.
By finding out that you didn't cut your grass or something. Awful.
They were looking for the smoking gun of fossil fuel connections.
Right. Like if you were secretly taking money from a big oil company, then that could take you down because obviously you would have a conflict of interest. But with science, like it seems like I understand that, a fossil fuel company wants to keep selling fossil fuels, and so they have a conflict of interest when they're spending money on research. They're not doing it just because they're nice guys, but it seems there's a built-in conflict of interest in academia. Like if you're getting grants for global warming because it's perceived as political, potentially catastrophic event that you're helping prevent, if somebody comes along and says, well, it's not really going to be catastrophic, that's actually threatening your status, it's threatening your grant funding, and maybe even will threaten your position at the university if things turn around and everybody says, we don't care about global warming anymore, let's just stop funding meteorological research. I mean, do you see that with scientists who are in the establishment side of any issue, that they feel that their funding is threatened if critics
want to see the big bucks keep flowing, okay? And they've developed this social contract, with the government effectively, and it's very mutually beneficial, and they don't want to see that stop.
Right, and I mean, if the government cut funding for, say, global warming research or AIDS research in half, then there'd be a tremendous number of scientists out of work. Their labs would dramatically shrink. There would be no more graduate students. I mean, it would really mess everything up for them, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, are there any major topics in this area that we haven't touched on in this discussion?
Oh, I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Okay. I think so too. I mean, it's interesting, and I think we all have a vested interest in the future of the planet, whether it's us or our, as the natives like to say, the seven generations upcoming in the future. But it's not like the impact of global warming is just we should burn less coal. There's some things associated with it, such as engineering the atmosphere, that I think could be pretty scary.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. And I'll include a link to your university website, I guess, and your blog in the show notes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
As I close today, I want to talk about the terrible events in Nice and Munich. Many people have noted that antidepressants, especially the SSRI drugs, as well as other psychiatric drugs, can cause psychotic episodes, as well as suicidal ideation, that is, thoughts of suicide or even actual suicide. In both cases, in Nice and Munich, it appears that the killers were being treated by a psychiatrist, which usually means drug treatment. What's interesting is that the media don't seem interested in the specifics. Questions that need to be asked are, what if any drugs were these men on? Do any of the side effects on the particular drugs they were taking correspond with murder-suicide? Everybody loves a good jihad story, and I'm not saying this wasn't one factor. Although it seems that Nice killer Mohamed Boulail showed no interest in religion, let alone jihad, until recently, if at all. And he had other issues in his life. His wife had asked for divorce. He may have been bisexual and dealing with similar internal conflicts as the Pulse nightclub killer. According to French media, BFMTV, Boulail had, quote, pictures of both female and male sexual conquests on his phone, unquote. Boulail had been, according to his father and mother, his father and sister, as quoted by Newsweek, seeing a psychiatrist for a number of years and having had what they called a nervous breakdown between 2002 and 2004. According to an English language French news site, the local.fr, he took drugs, drank alcohol, and was a bodybuilder, which could mean he also took steroids that can cause severe emotional changes, what's referred to as roid rage. The Munich killer, David Ali Somboli, had a similar story. Not a known jihadist, although a Muslim, but under psychiatric treatment for depression, making it almost certain that he was on antidepressants. Or perhaps recently off them, the drugs can cause worsening of symptoms during withdrawal, especially when people quit cold turkey. Again, the press don't seem too interested in the details of their treatments, what drugs, what side effects. We don't know which psychiatric drugs they were taking. In fact, it's possible, but unlikely, they were receiving solely talk therapy. Unlikely because that's more expensive and it's easier for governments to put people on drugs and claim things are under control. A group called the Citizens Committee for Human Rights has documented the warnings on antidepressant drug labels and has found the following from labels in the US, UK, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, Russia, Italy, Denmark, and Germany. 37 labels mentioned suicide. 10 mentioned hostility, violence, and/or aggression. 9 documented or reported withdrawal symptoms, i.e. the drugs are addictive. 5 warned about mania or psychosis. 4 warned about hallucinations or delusional thinking, and 1 about homicidal ideation, that is, thinking about murder. In 2011, the Institute for Safe Medication Practices reported that antidepressants were well represented in the top 10 drugs associated with violent behavior, as reported in the journal PLOS-1. The countdown includes number 10, Pristique, an antidepressant that is 7.9 times more likely to be associated with violence than other drugs. Number 9, Effexor, an antidepressant similar to Pristique, 8.3 times more likely. Number 8, Luvox, also an antidepressant, 8.4 times. Number 7, Halcyon, not an antidepressant, but another psychiatric drug, a benzodiazepine. Number 6, Strattera, is a psychoactive drug, but for ADHD, not depression. Number 5, Mefloquine, is actually a malaria drug that we've talked about before in episodes 67 and 70. Number 4 are the amphetamines. Number 3, back to the antidepressants, Paxil. See episode 93, where we talked to a survivor of Paxil. Number 2, Prozac, 10.9 times more likely to cause violence than average. Number 1, the winner, is actually a surprise. It's the anti-smoking medication Chantix, 18 times more likely to be associated with violence, but slightly more likely to make you quit smoking, especially if you end up behind bars for life. Thank you for listening to episode 111 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.